dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are privileged to have with us a former naval intelligence officer who went on after his service to our country in the uniform of the United States Navy to serve in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses. He also served as an assistant secretary of state in the George W. Bush administration. Among other roles, he is an author of Eagles and Evergreens, terrific book about World War II veterans in a Maine town. And he is a prolific contributor through Fox News and the Association of Mature Adult Citizens and other outlets of just terrific commentary about the public policy issues of our day. His name, of course, is Robert Charles. We're always delighted to have him with us. Bobby, welcome back and Happy New Year to you. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Qasem Soleimani and the difficulty President Trump is having at the moment persuading people that he was a legitimate military target and indeed that it was a huge success to remove him from the battlefield. And I'm under no illusion about that, but what do you say to people who are?
Well, you know, I really think it's incontrovertible, Frank. This Soleimani, if you track his record back to 1979, this is an individual who was involved in the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon. This is an individual who seeded the Hezbollah arms in places like Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen. And frankly, as people may or may not know, Hezbollah is active all over the world, including in this hemisphere. So Soleimani was the epitome of evil. I mean, he was a guy that that intentionally killed not just Americans and not just Westerners, but he killed Arabs that were of a different persuasion from himself. He was completely in the tank for terrorism, and then of course turned the terror machine that he had created inward on Iran and killed 1,500 innocent protesters in the last 6 or 7 weeks. I will tell you, Frank, that one of the most disturbing things I've learned in the last week or two is that after the IRGC and other arms of the Iranian government killed their own people, they then took the bodies to the homes of the people they'd killed and charged them money for the government coffers to get the bodies back. So they're just a despicable crowd. And look, the stars don't line up very often, but they did in this moment. Trump took the shot and he was right on.
And it was a twofer as well that he got one of his senior subordinates running these actual Iranian militia.
He actually got six leaders. They haven't talked much about the other ones, but this was a convening at the Baghdad airport of some real bad guys, and they took a number of them out.
I had no idea there was that many. Well done. You know, there's an interesting conversation going on in Washington at the moment. Your litany of crimes with which Qasem Soleimani has been associated was very illuminating, Bobby, but there's one that I think you missed that has been demonstrated to the satisfaction of a federal district judge in court in this country. Namely, that Iran, and that would be specifically Soleimani and the Quds Force IRGC, were actually involved in training the Saudi jihadists who perpetrated the 9/11 attack. And I mention it because one of the things that is now being bruited, I heard Senator Mike Lee on the Sunday programs this weekend bemoaning the fact that we no longer have appropriate authorization for the use of military force. But in fact, the last time I checked, the extant authorization specifically charged the United States military with taking out those responsible for the 9/11 attacks. You've studied these things more closely than I am, sure, but what make of all that you?
Yes, so you're right. There is a statute that passed after 9/11 that has continued to be in force. And let me back up quickly to Soleimani. You know, one thing I didn't say, and we should have, is that as the president revealed the other day, he had an attack underway in planning to the point of execution being around the corner to attack four U.S. embassies, and of course had been involved in the Shiite militias, not only in their IEDs that killed American soldiers in Iraq, but also in the planning of that sort of pre-event at the American embassy in Baghdad. But to your point, you know, we have two simple points. One, there's statutory authorization, and there ought to be. I don't know about the links between Soleimani and the Saudis, but you know, given the fact that he was really the father of terrorism across the region, and that those hijackers, although they largely came out of Saudi Arabia, they were linked to other organizations all over, from Hamas, pick your poison. But these organizations all track back in a sort of a link analysis to Soleimani in one form or another. So he was a kingpin, and I find it absolutely unthinkable that Americans, of any American in particular, would look at this and say, well, this wasn't good for the world. This is an individual who's, as they said, Rolodex included every terrorist organization on the, almost every terrorist organization, certainly every with Islamic radical Islamic ties, you know, on the globe. And so, you know, when you have an opportunity, it's like if you had the opportunity to take out Goebbels or Kesserling or one of the Nazi generals who ultimately became responsible for killing many Americans, and he had a track record already for doing so, you wouldn't hesitate in taking that action. On the question about statutes, look, I tend to think that a president is the commander in chief. I guess I get that idea from the Constitution. I tend to the idea that Article 2 is more clear about that, not that the declaration of war for an extended period and the deployment of large numbers of troops wouldn't be incumbent on Congress, but that a president has the power as a commander-in-chief to take actions exactly like the ones he's been taking. And I don't think there's anything in a, you know, a putative War Powers Act, which is probably unconstitutional to begin with, it's never been tested, that would stop him. You know, we always say that a president takes actions consistent with the War Powers Act, not pursuant to it, because it's never been tested as constitutional and probably isn't.
And so, Bobby, if you were to be asked about what the Senate should do in considering its version of a War Powers resolution on Iran this week, perhaps, what would you recommend?
I'd put them in rank order 1, 2, 3. I think they should demur on a vote like that because you don't tie a president's hands at a time when foreign powers all over the world, in particular Iran, are looking at him. Secondly, if you had to pass something, I suppose I'd pass the concurrent resolution because it requires no signature from the president. It is a precatory sort of this is what we think you ought to do kind of a document. I would not pass the one that they are considering in the Senate right now, which would require a presidential signature. And the idea is that he would not sign it, but that it would be sort of sending him a legislative demand that he not undertake further military action pursuant to Iran. Look, when you have an aggressor state like Iran, the last thing you want to be doing is tying the hands of your commander-in-chief.
I couldn't agree more. We hope they won't do it, but I fear there may be enough Republicans willing to take such a step under this circumstance to do just that. We appreciate your time, Bobby Charles. I hope they will be heeding your counsel and that you'll keep coming back to us with more of it. Thank you very much for your time today. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll talk with him about this extraordinary vote in Taiwan and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on Asia, specifically our interests there, most especially as they are being afflicted, I think is the right term for it, by communist China. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and the newest publication, Losing South Korea, He writes frequently for the Daily Beast and for National Interest and other publications. You see him frequently at Fox. We're always delighted to have him with us, though, here at Secure Freedom Radio. You can follow Gordon Chang on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back. And again, Happy New Year to you, my friend. It got a lot happier, I think, with the extraordinary response by the people of Taiwan to the stark choice that was presented to them in this presidential election on Saturday. Gordon, tell us a little bit about the outcome and what it portends, both as far as they're concerned and perhaps as far as Communist China is concerned.
President Tsai Ing-wen won re-election on Saturday with about 57.1% of the vote, which was extraordinary. She wasn't even going to win renomination by her own party, but the protests in Hong Kong convinced people in Taiwan once again that the one country, two systems formula that Beijing wants to impose on Taiwan, and which is in effect in Hong Kong, really was awful for them. Even the opposition candidate, Han Kuo-yu, who was the mayor of Kaohsiung, a big city in the south, he was the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party, which once ruled Taiwan. Even he was against one country, two systems, because obviously Beijing was not honoring its promises of a high degree of autonomy for 50 years. This is important because it shows that democracy is consolidating in Taiwan, that what we're seeing are institutions are withstanding China's assault. Because in the weeks and months before the election, China was trying to influence the results in favor of the Kuomintang candidate, Han, and against the incumbent president, Tsai. So this is great news for freedom throughout the world.
It was a dramatic and even decisive mandate that was given to Tsai, but it was also, in terms of just the sheer numbers of people voting, it was, I think, a record-setting outcome as well. Is that right?
Yes, she won slightly more than 8 million votes, 8.1 million votes. The previous record was 7.6 million votes, which is a real indication that the turnout really was heavy and that it was decisively in favor of President Tsai. And this is clearly a rejection of Beijing. Beijing took it that way with obviously repetition of its statements that Taiwan is irrevocably part of China. And that narrative is not true. The People's Republic of China has never ruled Taiwan, and Taiwan was part of what we call a Chinese state only for a very short period. And by the way, that Chinese state was actually a Manchu state. So China and Taiwan were actually parts of a foreign power that had conquered China. So clearly, Beijing's current narrative is not true, and Taiwan is an independent country, as it has all the attributes of being one.
And yet, what we're hearing from Beijing is, it seems to me, increasingly ominous, that what they are signaling is this won't stand, that there's going to be reunification, it's inevitable. And unfortunately, as we've talked about from time to time, both with you and other guests, the capacity of China to assert itself in this fashion through an invasion, even one that would be very short notice, is seemingly very much on the rise. Is that right?
Yes, there's growing concerns in the last several days of an invasion by China, because clearly, Beijing understands it's lost hearts and minds. And by the way, Frank, people in Taiwan, they don't say reunification because they believe correctly that the People's Republic of China and Taiwan were never part of the same state. They say unification. And obviously, that's ominous given the circumstances of Beijing's threats to use force.
It is indeed. And Gordon, as you look at this, obviously this is a huge win, as you say, for freedom. And I think for people not just on Taiwan, but elsewhere, it's got to be heartening to the people of Hong Kong as well. What should the United States be doing at this moment to increase deterrence to China, lest it be tempted to think it can actually act forcibly against the people of Taiwan?
The United States, and this should come from President Trump himself, should say publicly and in private to Beijing that the United States will defend Taiwan. There should be no strategic ambiguity, which has been our policy for decades. You know, because of ambiguity, Kim Il-sung, the North Korean dictator, thought that he could invade South Korea in 1950, which is what he did. And just to go back, Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of the State at the time, publicly drew America's Western defense perimeter, not including South Korea. His public declaration that the United States did not consider South Korea to be part of its defense perimeter actually allowed Kim to convince both Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union and Mao Zedong of China that the Americans would not defend South Korea. So he got the green light to invade. And of course, we defended South Korea. So this ambiguity has really worked against us. And then, of course, there's that other example that people talk about, and that is just 8 days before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, he sat down with the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie. Saddam Hussein asked Glaspie about his disagreements with Kuwait, and Glaspie, acting on instructions from Washington, said the U.S. had no interest in intra-Arab disputes. Saddam Hussein reasonably took that as a view that the U.S. would not defend Kuwait, and so he invaded. This is, again, another unnecessary war caused by ambiguity. We don't need a third one, Frank.
We certainly don't, especially when there's so much on the line, as would be the case here with Taiwan. Gordon, you mentioned Hong Kong just very quickly. I understand that there is a new video of a very troubling kind about what seems to be part of a crackdown in Hong Kong. Tell us what the video shows and what may be behind it.
In the last few hours, a video shows a limp body falling from a building in a police compound in Hong Kong. There is a hand which pushes the body out the window. Obviously, this was meant to depict a suicide, but there have been corpses showing up in Hong Kong periodically. And this is an indication that protesters have been dying in police custody, as protesters have been alleging. This goes back to August 31. When apparently three protesters disappeared in the Mong Kok, in the Prince Edward MTR, that's a subway station right next to the Mong Kok police station, which is the reason why we have all these protests there on the 31st of each month. Frank, this is serious because the Hong Kong police are apparently killing protesters, and the international community needs to react. And that, of course, includes the United States.
Gordon, let me turn to the home front here. On the 15th, Wednesday of this week, President Trump will be presiding over a signing ceremony of the Phase One agreement. In addition, he has commissioned his Treasury Secretary, who is among those who have been pushing hard for getting behind us this nasty problem with trade, Steven Mnuchin, former Goldman Sachs executive. He will be leading resumed so-called, I think, strategic dialogue with Beijing every 6 months or so. I know you're not a fan of this Phase One agreement. Remind us why, and talk a little bit about the implications of this so-called strategic dialogue as well.
I'm not a fan of the Phase One deal. We haven't seen the terms of it yet. Apparently, there are 86 pages, and so far, we've only seen a one-page fact sheet from the U.S. Trade Representative. But I'm not a fan of the agreement in general because we've had so many failed trade agreements with China, and so I don't think the remedy for this record of failure is another trade agreement, especially because we've given up something which is really important, which is some of our Section 301 tariffs on China, and gotten back very little. President Trump touts China's promises of increased purchases of U.S. products, especially agricultural products, but China has to buy U.S. ag anyway. And the reason is that there's a severe food crisis in China right now. Not only do you have the African swine fever problem that has killed more than half of China's pigs, you've got the armyworm problem affecting crops. Even if China were not to buy U.S. ag, they'd have to buy more ag from other countries. And that means because there's only so much agriculture in the world at this moment, the United States would sell to the traditional customers of those selling to China. So we gave up a lot, got very little in return. We probably got some promises, especially on intellectual property. But those promises, you know, we've had promises like that from China before. The only way we're going to actually get anywhere is not talking to the Chinese, like this dialogue that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin will spearhead, but actually imposing costs until those costs are so high that China has to stop stealing our intellectual property and stop its increasingly predatory trade behavior violating its obligations to us.
This will, of course, be playing out in part in whether there is a second phase to this process or not. But Gordon, talk a little bit about the strategic dialogue. Is that something that in the past has actually helped us vis-a-vis China, or is it just another vehicle for being diddled by them?
Yeah, we've had these dialogues, these half-yearly dialogues, in the previous two administrations. And really what happens is because we have this dialogue, we do not take effective action. We decide that we're going to talk to China. China delays. While it delays, it steals more U.S. IP, commits more trade violations. So consultation has proven not to be effective in the past. You know, we Americans always like to think that we can just talk to people, reason with them. And indeed, if we're dealing with another democracy, yeah, of course we could do that. But China is a predatory trader. It doesn't believe in comparative advantage, which is the basis of the international system of commerce. And so I really think that this is a waste of time and certainly very detrimental to the U.S. because it'll prevent us from taking action, which we need to take. We need to increase those Section 301 tariffs to the sky. Forget about 25% tariffs. We should be talking 250% tariffs, 2,500% tariffs. We just need to stop what has been an ineffective approach to China.
Well, the president has been trying, I think, up to a point. The question is whether he's now being talked out of it. We'll follow it closely in 2020, as I know will you. Gordon, thank you for joining us. We'll be very grateful for your insights in the weeks ahead on this subject and much more. Next up, we will speak with Rosemary Jenks about immigration challenges. Are they getting better or worse? That and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm pleased to say we're joined by a friend and colleague of many years, a woman who I've come to admire as truly one of the great thinker activists on matters involving tremendously important public policy portfolio, namely immigration, legal and illegal. Her name is Rosemary Jenks. She is the Director of Government Relations at a terrific organization, Numbers USA. You can follow its work and hers at numbersusa.com. She has graced this program many times in 2019, and we're looking forward to having her back on a regular basis in 2020 as well. Rosemary, thanks for taking some time with us today. It's good to have you back. Do tell us what your reading is at the moment of the state of immigration, legal and illegal, in this country, and specifically whether it's getting worse at the moment or not so much.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, of course, legal immigration is governed by statute. And so that is in a status quo mode at the moment. Congress hasn't changed it dramatically in years. Unfortunately, the status quo, in our view, is too many. We're admitting over a million legal immigrants per year, and we think that number needs to come down to ensure that immigration policy suits the needs of Americans first.
Just to pause on that, Rosemary, just to take that in, a million legal immigrants per year in a population of something like 327 million, that's a lot of people who are being added, even if there's not a single person coming in illegally. And of course, that's not the case. What is Numbers USA's recommendation with respect to legal immigration?
So there are some legal immigration categories that just need to be eliminated, including the visa lottery, where we just randomly hand out visas to people from countries that haven't sent a lot of immigrants in the past. There's no need for us to be randomly handing out visas.
That's a policy that the president has personally spoken about, has he not? And chain migration as well. And yet this is still going forward unchanged?
It is going forward unchanged because that's what's in the law right now. And of course, there's no agreement on anything in Congress, let alone on this. And of course, the Democrats are in favor of mass immigration because it means more Democrat voters. The Republicans, a lot of Republicans, unfortunately, are also in favor of mass immigration because it means cheap labor. So we need to get them out of that mindset and remind them that they're representing Americans and need to do what's best for our country, not what's best for their bottom line.
Yeah, or specific businesses in their constituency, perhaps, that they're mindful of. Okay, so turn to illegal immigration. What is the status of the illegal influx of, you know, foreign nationals?
There's actually a little bit of good news, at least for the moment, on illegal immigration. Because the Trump administration has taken significant steps, both in working with Mexico, which has been huge, and the Central American countries that have been sending all of the unaccompanied alien children and the family units, we are now seeing the numbers of Central Americans coming across the border starting to inch downward. I think there was a 5% decline in the December apprehension numbers, which isn't huge, and we're still at a crisis, but at least it is going down. So the trend is in the right direction. The Trump administration has taken significant actions, including the Remain in Mexico policy, where asylum seekers have to wait in Mexico for their claims to be heard. There are also changes happening to the credible fear process so that we no longer have 98% or so of asylum applicants getting past that first threshold, even though everyone in the system knows that they don't have a legitimate claim. So that's all changing, and it is affecting the numbers. One trend that we're seeing that is very concerning, though, is that we're seeing an increase in Mexican nationals again. It used to, you know, for decades, Mexican nationals were the vast majority of those crossing the border illegally. That went down when the Central American crisis started, and Central Americans were the majority of those coming across. But Mexico has risen back up to the top of the list again.
Does that have something to do with the intensifying gang warfare and drug violence in Mexico, would you say? Or is this simply a function of people still looking for economic opportunities on our side of the border, or some combination of the two?
Well, it's definitely a combination, but it's primarily because of the drug smuggling organizations, drug and human smuggling organizations, tied to the cartels. Because of the Central American issue, the smugglers learned that, you know, bringing a child makes a big difference. So they've been getting Mexican nationals to pay them to smuggle in a child. And so they're trying to use the same techniques that worked for Central Americans with Mexican nationals now. And because if a Mexican national applies for asylum in the United States, we can't send them back to Mexico to wait for their asylum claim to be heard, because it's Mexico that they're saying they're afraid of. So that's a big catch in the system, where we have to figure out how to deal with those Mexicans. And it looks like they may be sent to other Central American countries to wait for their asylum claims to be heard. But that remains to sort of be seen how that's all going to work out. But it is concerning that trend is happening, despite the overall numbers going down.
Now, Rosemary, give us an update on the wall. I know you don't regard it as a panacea by any means, but there does seem to be some progress in the judiciary with respect to the president's efforts to build the wall. Am I right?
Yes. And I think Fifth Circuit Appellate Court just overturned a district judge who was trying to block the money from the Defense Department being used to build the wall. That has now been freed up by the appellate court. So there is money for new wall to be built. This is, you know, a very slow process with government contractors, unfortunately. So I don't think that they're going to get, I think the president was talking about 450 miles of wall built before the end of this year. That is unlikely to happen, but at least they're on the path of building more wall in places where it's necessary.
And if it's not a panacea, but a necessary help in impeding illegal aliens from coming here, what else is urgently needed? You have spoken on this program, among other places, about something called mandatory E-Verify. Remind us what that is and why it is so important.
So E-Verify is an electronic system that allows employers to verify that their new hires are lawfully eligible to work in the United States. It's a very simple process. It uses Social Security information and DHS immigration information to essentially verify someone's legal work authorization. So if you're here illegally and you make up a Social Security number, you will not get through that system. If you steal someone else's Social Security number, you won't get through that system unless you have stolen their entire identity. But this is, it's an extraordinarily popular program. It's popular with employers who use it. It's popular among the public. And it is really the best way to stop illegal immigration, because we all know that people are coming here for jobs. They're coming for economic opportunity. And if they can't get jobs, if they're here illegally, then they have no choice but to go home.
And it is sufficiently reliable and accurate that it doesn't give a lot of false positives and therefore cause people not to want to use it. If it is so popular, why isn't it being universally employed?
Well, that's the thing. It should be universally employed. It should be mandatory, because if you're, for example, in a landscaping occupation and you're the owner of a landscaping business and you use E-Verify because you want to follow the law, but your competitor down the road does not use E-Verify and therefore can pay cheaper wages, no benefits, and all the rest of the advantages, then you, the law-abiding employer, are actually at a competitive disadvantage because E-Verify is not mandatory. So we need to level the playing field and give employers the tools that they need. And, you know, it is amazing because for a government program, it is astonishingly accurate. And, you know, that's hard to imagine, but it is really a well-run government program that is free for employers, makes it easy for them to determine someone's work eligibility in just a matter of literally a few seconds.
So this would seem to be something that ought to be part of a new statutory reform for immigration. There's been talk that the administration, in the person of the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is coming up with a plan for immigration reform after the huge histrionics in the Congress last year about child separation, family separation, people being kept in cages and so on. There was presumably a lot of appetite for that. Is there likely to be any reform coming out of the Congress? And if there is it likely to be any good?
Well, you know, it is very difficult to see the House Democrats doing anything useful on immigration. They seem determined on essentially opening the borders and letting in as many people as possible. So I have a hard time believing that they will go along with anything that includes adequate enforcement, mandatory E-Verify, lowering immigration numbers. You know, I think they will be doing all the wrong things. And it's unclear what the Senate would do, you know, if they were given a bad bill. We've seen with the Gang of Eight and so on that there are a number of Republican senators who are more than happy to go along with amnesty for all and, you know, the rest of it.
So the best we can hope for is no action in election season, would you say?
That is unfortunately true. And the problem with that is, of course, that the status quo means 1.1, 1.2 million legal immigrants per year, continuing illegal immigration. So the status quo is not what we want, but that's where we are.
Rosemary Jenks, thank you very much for your time today, as well as your insights and your hard work on trying to protect our country from the negative effects of immigration, ill-advised legal as well as illegal immigration. Numbers USA is a tremendous resource. Again, numbersusa.com is where you can follow it. Join Numbers USA and Rosemary Jenks' important work if you can. Rosemary, come back to us again often in 2020, if you will. This is a vital work, and we're anxious to keep abreast of it all. Next up, we will speak with Richard Pollack of OAN, Investigative Unit, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we're joined by a longtime colleague, a man who has worked in the media in a whole host of capacities, and who has acquitted himself brilliantly as both an investigative reporter and as a producer and as a source for very pertinent information about the key public policy issues of our time. He is these days a senior investigative reporter for One America News Network, a terrific, relatively new television network. And Richard Pollack is working tirelessly to bring to bear his skills in investigative reporting for that network, and most recently has been doing some important reporting on a topic that caught my eye because it bears on a subject that might feature in the upcoming trial of Donald Trump in the United States Senate, namely the propensity to abuse power by working with corrupt Ukrainians for the purposes of personal gain. This is, of course, the charge against President Trump, the first of the two charges against him. It turns out that, according to investigative reporting by Richard Pollack, that there are some others who are at least as culpable, if not considerably more, and from whom the Senate might want to hear as witnesses. We're happy to have a chance to visit with him. Richard Pollack, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I think it's the first time we've talked since you took on this new gig with OAN. Congratulations on that, and Happy New Year to you. Let's talk a little bit about what you have been uncovering at OAN with respect to the kinds of corruption that seems endemic with powerful Ukrainian figures, oligarchs and political figures and so on. And I'm particularly interested in what you and others have turned up in terms of Hunter Biden and Joe Biden and their abuse of power.
Well, there's no question of abuse of power. The former vice president told a public meeting at the Council on Foreign Relations that he basically did a shakedown with the Ukrainian government to get a corruption prosecutor who was looking into his son's activities, his son's investments and roles on a board of directors of Burisma, which was a Ukrainian company. And he got them to get the dogs out, off of them rather, in a way to get the prosecutors to stop looking into his son and into this corrupt natural gas company. Now, one of the things that I want to just mention, just to give your audience a sense of the depth of the corruption, is no one really has addressed the issue. Well, what did this oligarch that broke bread with Hunter Biden really do? Why were corrupt prosecutors or corruption prosecutors looking at it? And the fact is that this particular man, this oligarch, was one who had a role with the communist government of the Ukraine, with the really ruthless communist dictator Kuchma. And he was in charge of natural gas and oil reserves in Ukraine. That's when this oligarch created a natural gas company and began to get below market gas contracts through the government. Then he joined the pro-Moscow government of Yanukovych, and Yanukovych appointed him the Minister of Natural Resources and the Environment, which then gave him, again, an insider role with respect to natural gas. He became the largest independent natural gas company through those two roles, those two corrupt roles that he had. And then after that, and when the anti-corruption prosecutors were going after him, he needed protection, and that's why he chose Hunter Biden, who had basically no experience whatsoever in the natural gas field at all. He had a famous name, and that name was Biden.
And the other factor here, though, that really speaks to the abuse of power, as I understand it, Richard Pollack, is that the vice president at the time, Joe Biden, was the man who had the Ukraine portfolio for the U.S. government. He was the guy who was directly interfacing with the government of Ukraine. He was the one who was arranging for it to receive U.S. assistance, not military assistance, by the way. President Obama, of course, didn't provide that, but other assistance. And in this instance, as you say, at the Council on Foreign Relations, he pled guilty to having withheld that assistance until and unless he got satisfaction in terms of this guy who was investigating his son, right?
I think that's absolutely right. And if the Senate decides in its trial to accept different witnesses, I think that it would be invaluable for both the former vice president and his son, Hunter Biden, to be witnesses there and to answer the questions of the senators. My own sense about it is that we've already heard what the bill of retainer is from the House, and I think the Senate should probably vote up and down whether or not they think, based on the, I think, very weak evidence, whether they should convict him of these two articles. But I think that if they decide they want to go forward with guests or with witnesses, then I think both the former vice president and his son should be there.
Now, Richard Pollack, you've also done a recent investigative report on another Ukrainian oligarch who had the distinction of having posted, according to your reporting, a $174 million bail bond. I don't know if that's a world record, but I've got to believe it's a contender. Give us just quickly the backstory here. I don't know that it's directly relevant to the impeachment saga, but it is a fantastic tale that bears out what a cesspool Ukrainian politics has been and continues to have American attachments, as best I can tell, including that of a fellow by the name of Lanny Davis.
Well, Dmitry Firtash is another oligarch. Almost all of these oligarchs were either former Communist Party members or part of the communist government, and they were able to get all sorts of goodies from the Ukrainian natural resources at bargain basement prices. But this particular oligarch, in addition to that, was trying to go and do a corrupt deal in India involving Boeing Aircraft Corporation. The Obama administration and the U.S. prosecutor in Chicago wanted to get him into the country to face these charges. And what he did was he ran to Austria and he put up, as you said, a huge bail in order to stay there. Now, he's in big trouble. He's in big trouble for that. He's in big trouble for other corrupt issues. He needs a prominent Washington representative. And who does he choose? He chooses Lanny Davis. Now, many people may recall Lanny Davis because he was what I call the apologist in chief for a guy named Bill Clinton. He was Bill Clinton's main mouthpiece during all of those scandals. He defended the president from top to bottom. And then he decided to take on between $60,000 and $80,000 each month over the last 5 years. He's been representing this corrupt oligarch. Now, it turns out that he fired him, and there are some people associated with Rudy Giuliani. They are tangentially associated to Rudy Giuliani, who also had dealings with Firtash. And lo and behold, the mainstream media is talking about Rudy Giuliani and his connection to this corrupt oligarch while ignoring the last 5 years that Lanny Davis was the mouthpiece for this oligarch. It's an amazing story.
It is. And I'm struck by the fact that, as I recall, Hunter Biden was pulling down, at least by some accounts, $80,000 a month for his service on this Burisma board. And here you've got Lanny Davis getting that kind of retainer. These Ukrainian oligarchs are obviously paying handsomely for the services of people who can help them, you know, wend their way through the kinds of wickets that they have to get through in official Washington. And very quickly, where do you come down on the advisability of the Senate having witnesses as part of its Senate trial? Do you have a few on that?
I think it's a double-edged sword. I think that on one level, the Senate ought to just say, okay, let's take all the witnesses to the extent that the House has listened to them. Let's not call any witnesses. Let's look at the evidence. Let's let the House, Senate, or House Republican and Democratic managers make the case. Let's vote. And I think that that's the cleanest way of doing it, since it was up to the Democrats to go and raise the issue of witnesses. On the other hand, I think it would be just very delicious to have someone like Joe Biden on the stand, and to have Hunter Biden on the stand, and to have other Democrats that have been involved in very nefarious things in Ukraine, including George Soros, I might add. I mean, it would be very tempting to put a little parade of prominent Democrats, including Democrat donors, members of Congress, etc., who have been enablers of these corrupt oligarchs. That would be a great show. On the other hand, in terms of the interest of the Constitution and the interest of having, you know, a president who needs to deal with the world and its many challenges, I think that maybe having a quick up and down vote of what the House raised probably, to me, makes much more sense.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Richard Pollack of One American News Network, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll look forward to further visits with you in the course of 2020. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.